History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And by now, I think we know they don't have to go untold, right? As long as we're willing to take the initiative and ask a few questions and, of course, invest a little time in listening patiently. We might just end up amazed as long-buried memories come to life once again. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, not only are we educated, not only do we find ourselves entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Our guest today is 97-year-old World War II Army veteran George Paul of Henderson, Nevada. We're going to hear some of the things he witnessed at the tail end of the war in Europe, as well as some of the interesting projects he worked on after the war and a long career as an engineer for Boeing. But to get things started, we always like to go back to the beginning. An only child in a Greek family in South Chicago in the late 20s and 1930s. What in the world was that like?
Well, it was kind of an interesting life because South Chicago is kind of the only habitable area near the steel mill, which was at the bottom of Lake Michigan. My mother had an uncle who operated a residential hotel. That is, he rented out rooms. We had gone to Greece, my mother and I, because she wanted to visit her family, her mother, and she had a brother and a sister, and they were in the northern part of Greece, and they were originally Greeks who had lived a lifetime in western Turkey, in what they called Asia Minor. They were essentially illiterate, because that was Turkey, of course, and even though they were free to practice their religion and have schooling that the church sponsored, they weren't free as citizens. And so the consequence of that was that the people of her generation around the turn of the century were being conscripted into the Turkish army. And of course they didn't want to be in the Turkish army because it wasn't them. And the net result of that was that many of them were beginning to emigrate, and some of them found their way to the United States. That group included, of course, my mother's uncle, and he wound up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and he had a little business of doing what they call a hat cleaning operation. Men used to wear fedoras, as you remember, so on and so forth. And so they got into that business, and then somehow he broke away from that and wound up in South Chicago and had this 12-room hotel. My mother decided to go and visit her people who were in northern Greece, had been relocated from the island of Samos, which is just off the coast of western Turkey there, and so forth. And so they were relocated and were given plots of land, and so they became tobacco farmers. They didn't know anything about raising tobacco, but that's where so-called Turkish tobacco used to be farmed. She wanted to see her family. So she and I, at that time, I was 11 years old. And of course, I had already been in school in the United States. But when I got to Greece, of course, in no school except Greek schools. So I wound up being enrolled in a public school in the village. Now, that was an interesting life for me because it was a brand new way of living. I had to learn another language, obviously. But my father had other plans, and so he wanted to divorce my mother, and so he left us there. And that was pretty rough because we had no income.
So you've gone from Chicago to Greece. You don't know how long you're staying for, but while you're there, your father drops this news on you?
Yes. As a matter of fact, he sued for divorce, and of course, it was uncontestable, so she couldn't afford a lawyer to handle her, and she didn't have any money to speak of because he was sending us a small amount of money per month so we could live there for as visitors. After about 2.5 years, she decided that Hitler was getting a little too active, and he had taken over Poland. It was the news of the century for all the rest of Europe because, well, we were at the tip of the Greek peninsula there, and then the Serbians were next door to us, and they were not necessarily of the Greek political spectrum, so to speak. She borrowed some money. Believe it or not, she borrowed $100 from another, you might say, cousin, third or fourth cousin, something like that. And she came to the United States. She shook the tree and got the Travelers Aid Society to help her. So they climbed on my father's butt and got him to contribute a trip for me to come back. So she left me there. And I had my 13th birthday on the ship coming back from France.
You know, you're saying all this like this is matter of fact, but I'm just trying to imagine what it's like to be a young boy, your father leaves, and then your mother goes back to the States without you and leaves you there by yourself?
Yeah, she left me there with her mother and sister and brother because they had a house. The intent was that she was going to get me to come back to the States, and I knew that was going to be in work because she arranged some of this stuff before she left Greece through the U.S. Embassy. They kind of made things simple for her when she got to New York to be handled because she didn't know English to that extent. She was a doer, and thank God for that, because if it weren't for her, I probably wouldn't be here today.
Well, yeah, and I'm just wondering what it's like, what kinds of things were going through your mind, because it seems like a very uncertain future that you're dealing with. And you spent 2.5 years there, so I'm interested in that perspective too. Like, what were some of the things you saw or experienced or felt in your time there in Greece?
Well, we were located in a village near the northern border between Greece and Bulgaria. And Bulgaria was not necessarily a friendly nation, politically speaking, with the Greeks. And so there was activity in that border area. Of course, it didn't affect me personally, but nevertheless, it was something to consider, and it was worrisome. And that's when my mother got scared and decided, well, we didn't belong there.
Have you ever stopped and thought, and I think you alluded to it a second ago, how different your life had been had you stayed behind and not been able to come to the States then?
I can't begin to tell you what fear that posed, even though politically speaking, I was ignorant. I still have felt the whole population of the village was up and are scared. They didn't know. I mean, they left World War I behind, and here they are facing another war with nowhere to turn to. They're at the end of the peninsula. So, yeah, I was absolutely delighted to leave Greece.
What was that journey like, though? You told us you celebrated your 13th birthday on the ship. That couldn't have been a quick journey, and I'm sure you didn't know what to expect.
Well, let's see. The outstanding European cruise line was Cunard. They were operating boats that they had confiscated from the Germans after World War I. And so I was on one of those. It was called the Berengaria, and it was a large boat in the sense of that period, very close to being a maximum-sized passenger liner. And that took us the better part of a week and a half. We left Cherbourg and wound up in New York. I was alone, of course. I had my own cabin because they made the arrangements through the agents here in the United States. And there were a couple of guys who were Greek citizens who acted as my guardians, and they agreed to do this, just kind of keep an eye on me. I didn't mind it because they were regular guys and closer to my age than my grandparents were. When I got to New York, of course, the Travelers Aid Society took over and housed me and got me clothes. They got rid of all the bugs I had and so on and so forth. They put me on the train and they got me to Chicago. Then my mom was there, and so we moved in. She already lived with her uncle. I just blended right in, and that was our home. So then we lived there at his pleasure, you might say, because he didn't charge. he didn't charge any rent, and we helped him maintain the little hotel and made the beds and painted and would do whatever needed to be done. We just helped him out. Mm-hmm. And then I kept going to school. Yeah, I graduated high school eventually in 1944. And the draft board was good enough to let me finish my high school because, well, they could see that the war in Europe was beginning to be more in favor of the Allies and so on and so on. So they left me be until I just turned 19. And they said, oops, we better put you to work. So off I went.
Well, I want to ask you about something before then, because everyone I've interviewed seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. You're a high school student at the time. What do you remember about that day?
It was horrible. It was just absolutely horrible. I think I cried a little bit. Yeah, all of us, my contemporaries, we didn't know about war. And it was a shock that we were attacked. And we thought that we were impervious to that sort of thing. After all, we're in America. It got better because I think everybody became conscious of the fact that we were Americans, we were good people, and we were on the side of the good.
And do you remember specifically how you got that news? Like what you were doing or how you found out that Imperial Japan had bombed Pearl Harbor?
It was on the radio, that was our only source of instantaneous news, you might say. We didn't get the newspaper per se, but nevertheless, but it was the talk of the radio, and you can imagine it was what had to be talked about for a week. What we didn't know was the details of the carnage that occurred even to this day. It's amazing that anybody survived in Hawaii. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah, it could have been a lot worse. Where'd you go to high school in Chicago?
I went to a high school that's right there inside the South Chicago area, if you please. And it was called Bowen High School, B-O-W-E-N. It was an old school. It was a four-story structure. To this day, it's there and covered in ivy. We had different kind of schools back in that era. The teachers were all older individuals, and we even had some male teachers in the high school. It was also had a shop so that you could opt to be either pre-college or you could opt to remain in the trades. And there was a couple of technical high schools in the Chicago area, one on the north side and one on the south side, which were selective in whom they accepted from the rest of the city. And you could specialize in carpentry or you could specialize in setting type for newspapers and printers and so on and so forth. Or you could become an electrician, auto mechanic, a variety of accepted trades. Well, I opted to be a college kid, and so I had to follow that curriculum, and that fitted me pretty well. So that worked out for me very nicely.
Yeah, you just had this little thing called the war that got in the way of your college education. And I'm curious how you saw life change in your community, in your school, in Greater Chicago, after Pearl Harbor. What was different?
What was different is that the grocery stores didn't sell the same stuff. We had to have coupons to buy butter, and we had to buy, if you bought meat, you had to have a coupon for certain cuts of meat that were available to us because most of it had to be shuttled off to the armed forces and so on and so on. And so it changed our lives in that respect. Gasoline was completely rationed. Of course, we didn't own a car. But on the other hand, everywhere you went, you had to take either a streetcar or a bus or something to go from place to place. There was scarcity of a lot of things. Clothing, for instance, was not necessarily what you wanted to buy. Our life changed, but it was acceptable. I don't remember that anybody. And the neighborhood, the whole neighborhood, which took in a large mileage, square mileage, was almost entirely all of people who were brought over from Europe. to work in the mills and so on and so forth. And of course, everybody worked, and they worked as many hours as they wanted to. So we were in a different lifestyle.
And do you remember, you know, in the midst of that, having some dreams, some ambitions? Hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Yes, sir. I wanted to be an engineer. I wanted to work on automobiles, even though I didn't know nothing about it. But I followed that pattern through my high school years, my last 2 years in high school. I went to work as a mechanic at the dealership because I wanted to learn about what makes these things work. And I wanted to follow that curriculum through college. We had no automobile designers in Chicago. But on the other hand, General Motors had a school that they sponsored and owned and matriculated enough engineers to staff their offices and so on and so on. Well, that didn't happen for me, but other things did happen along the same lines. And so that helped.
But first you had to survive the end of World War II. So you told us they let you graduate high school, the draft board, before they bring you into the Army. Was there a welcome to the Army moment for you? Was there a rude awakening? What was it like to make that transition from civilian high school student?
It was an awakening of some sort because I'd been an only kid. I had no relatives to speak of. And I lived with my mother, so I was mama's boy. But on the other hand, I was kind of independent in that my mother and her uncle treated me like I was an ordinary kid. They gave me all the freedom I needed. I didn't have to ask permission to go down the street and play baseball or whatever. I ran my own life, and the consequence of that was that being in an Army environment where we lived with 40, 50 guys in a barracks, kind of looked forward to it. It became a fun thing to be a part of this group of men, and most of us were kids. All of a sudden, it was just, hey, a new family. I loved it.
And what kind of training did you go through? Were there any highlights or things that stand out from your training period?
Well, yes. When I was drafted in the Army, I weighed 160-some pounds because I had kind of an easy job. I was hired as a draftsman at a company that did tank work in South Chicago and so on. So when I went into the Army, I was kind of a fatso, soft and so on. Of course, in basic training, you don't own your body. It belongs to everybody with stripes. And the consequence of that was that when I went home on an emergency leave because my mother's uncle passed away, and I had lost between 30 and 40 pounds, and that was just strictly due to training. We were constantly on walks and runs. Every morning you woke up, you had to go out to calisthenics. So my body changed drastically. When I went on, they didn't recognize me. But that was good.
And how long did it take to get an understanding of what your job was going to be in the Army?
Well, I went through basic training. I think that took us 6 weeks. Then we were culled, and then some of us were identified as being eligible for additional specialized training, again, within the Corps of Engineers. And so I wound up being put into they call it a carpentry school, but it was more than that. We had to learn how to pitch makeshift devices to lift heavy things like bridge components. So we went to a specialized training period of another 6, 7, 8 weeks. I forget exactly. And then from there, I was assigned to the 16th Armored Division in Camp Chaffee, Arkansas, which was one of those fortunate things for me because it was all mechanical stuff, and they kept me as a carpenter, and they assigned me whatever jobs they had identified as being of that MOS.
So what were some of those jobs?
Well, we had to learn how to repair some of the buildings that were tossed up during the early parts of the war, as a matter of fact, to house the huge army that was being put together. But at the same time, we were also being shown how to kill people. And that was probably most of it, hand-to-hand stuff. And which didn't appeal to me, but on the other hand, you got to do it. It became a new way to live in a brand new environment that no one really knew what was going to happen. Because in the early parts of the war, we weren't exactly number one.
For those of us who didn't live through World War II, it's easy to forget that. We have the lens of history in our favor, but 8 decades ago, things were very uncertain. It's time for our first break, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old George Paul. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our Vegas visit with 97-year-old George Paul, originally from Chicago. He had to make it home by himself from Greece as a teenager to avoid getting swept up in World War II there. Back here in the States, he was drafted into the Army and ended up in an engineer battalion as part of the 16th Armored Division. It's been a long, long time, George, but do you remember how you felt about heading overseas?
I didn't know where I was going to go.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about armored divisions and what kind of terrain they had to work in. But I knew that the war in the Pacific was different than the war in Europe was going to be. Because at that point in time, we hadn't landed in France and all that kind of stuff, so... And we were lucky in that we weren't included in that group, but there wasn't room for us. I guess the U.S. Army was all over Britain. But whatever lot we were given, we'd grumble and moan, and it's the hurry-up-and-wait stuff. But we always looked forward to something that was going to take all of our abilities to be a part of. Yeah, I all of us did. Most of the people who were being drafted during my draft period were in their 30s, and some were pushing 40. They came from areas back east where they were just called surplus, so the draft boards yanked them. But I was happy that I wound up where I did.
Where did you end up, and what did you find when you got there?
Well, we wound up, the whole division was somehow bivouacked in a huge area, I would think. But in our case, the engineering battalion was relegated to an area, it was a farm area. It was northeast of Paris, a long distance. And pretty close to what used to be France's borderline between them and Germany. We were bivouacked in a farm community. My platoon was put above the cow barn. And so that's where we set up our sleeping bags and all that kind of stuff, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I was assigned to another guy who was... I think a buck sergeant, and he was truly a carpenter. He was actually a builder. He was in his upper 30s, and he kind of liked his alcoholic beverages. And I didn't know very much about alcohol, but I learned how to drink an awful lot of apple juice. But anyhow, yes, that was a lot of fun. We were on constant errands to find things, but we were kept in reserve as a whole division for about 2 months in that same general area. As a matter of fact, we went to a church, Easter services in a cathedral, huge, huge building. Oh my God, that was new to kids like me. Mm-hmm. Who ever heard of a cathedral in Chicago? Mm-hmm. But anyhow, yeah, and then after that, we were slowly being pushed towards the east. We wound up going through some areas that were completely devastated by the U.S. forces, minor cities along the corridor that went from where we were into Nuremberg and so forth. So we were about that same latitude as Czechoslovakia. And so that's kind of the way we were going east in the so-called combat zone. So for that, we got a star. But we were not under any fire. But there was another group of our division, what they call the mechanized infantry, and they used to ride on those six-wheel drive units. They were caught in some pretty heavy fire. So they took some casualties, but not in our case.
Were you concerned that that could be something you experienced?
You accepted it. You just didn't, you didn't know what was going to happen. And that was the best part, because if you don't know, you can't anticipate other than be on your toes.
And you know, you talked about a lot of geography there, from France through Germany to what's now Czechia. What are some of the things you saw or witnessed along the way?
It was absolute devastation to see nothing but rubble. To go, when we went through southern Germany, there weren't buildings standing. It was just rubble, piles of rubble. And then from there, you'd be out in the country where the farms were and so on and so forth. And it was just like that from west of Nuremberg. There wasn't anything standing. When you think back on it, that all that had to be rebuilt, cleaned up, and rebuilt, and so on. Those poor folks were working for years and years, for God's sakes. And we were just going through. Well, that was life.
Well, and I think you got a pretty heavy taste of what life had been like for some of the people who were displaced or oppressed by that Nazi regime.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, that's true. Yes, even those who were not necessarily oppressed, like the Germans who had been brought into the Sudetenland when Hitler took that part of Czechoslovakia over under the guise that it always was German, you know. You walk carefully, and you walk where you think you're aware of where you are. Otherwise, you don't go there. You find that you're looking out for you and you only, and your bud, if your bud is with you. And so you look for him and he looks for you, and it works. Mm-hmm. It's a system that makes two people one in terms of being more effective. I thought that was comforting.
At one point along this journey, I don't want to skip over anything, but you ended up getting an understanding of some of the slave labor that Hitler's regime had enforced on people.
Yeah, that was horrible. Thank God that we didn't see any of those camps where they used to go gas the people. Other guys from our division did see some of that stuff. And I'll never forget the time when we had to go see the movies. Eisenhower said, "Thou shalt." As soon as they broke through some of those camps, why, we saw the movies. It was unbelievable, my friend. You don't know. Made you sick. How could a person do that? That's what we were dealing with. Thank God that war was over.
But you did get to meet and be around and actually stay in a facility that had been used for that, right? Where some women were forced to stay to work for that?
The thing about it was a surprise, obviously. Mm-hmm. and it was a surprise to find it on this man's estate.
Where was this?
This was a village that was just north and maybe a little bit east of Pilsen, yeah. And then between where we were and where Pilsen was, there was a big forest on the southwest side. That's where they had the airplanes, the German Air Force airplanes, hidden. So they weren't in what you would normally call an airport, mm-hmm. but they did have a runway. And that's where they had Stukas, and they had some heavy 109s. Oh, and then I remember one thing, it was really a show. A couple of U.S. pilots came by in B-51s. They came by too. And so they landed the airplanes on two guys. And then one guy jumped out. He went over to a Stuka. He wanted to fly it. So he got in, and the other guy got up on the wing, and he started cranking it because the batteries were dead. And they got it started, just a boop, but they both took off. Well, they were lucky that Pat wasn't there, and he just shot him on the spot. And they flew around, and they kind of chased each other and did a few things, and then they came and landed. And, of course, they put on quite a show for us. And that was the day after we got there. But it was playtime.
But the situation where you guys end up staying in this facility that had been to house slave laborers, what understanding did you get of what they had been doing and the impact of it?
No understanding at all as far as what the details were or what their lifestyle was like. But you could see from the clothing that they wore and their lack of healthy-looking bodies that they were just barely existing. It was horrible. And in talking to some of the ladies who were from Greece and had been used as laborers, they were content in that they were in the position that they were in because they could provide something that was wanted by the enemy, so to speak. And so they kept them fed, kind of. But they didn't have any fancy clothes, and they didn't have shoes to wear. It was a survival kind of a thing. And there's nothing that we could do because we were told to stay away because we didn't want to in any way harm them. And I guess you can understand that after you stop and think about it because they're not used to eating what we eat and all that kind of stuff. So I stayed away. Frankly.
Do you have any specific memories of VE Day and why that mattered or what it meant to you?
Yeah, they had the ceremony for signing the surrender of the German forces in that area right there at the airfield. We saw that, not that we understood it.
But you were there.
Yeah, we were there. That was the day after we got there. 8th of May. Mm-hmm. It was a nice day. Then we just dispersed and went back to our bivouac. We had our own rooms, our own, you might call them cabins, I suppose, but these were rooms in the building, and this was a honest-to-God castle. It had a huge, huge ballroom, and we had a party, and we invited all the German girls to come. And that pissed off the communists. Oh, that was horrible. Oh, my God. Well, that excited some stray bullets to come. Not that they aimed at anyone, because they recognized the so-called partisans. They recognized that they were outshot if they wanted to start another war. But at the same token, we had to be careful because, well, you could get into trouble.
Did you ever get into any trouble in the Army?
No, not there. No, 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 no. I guess the Third Army wanted to make some of the highways usable for their heavy equipment to go back and forth as part of the Army of Occupation. And so they wanted to build some bridges so that the heavy trucks and tanks could be deployed in the event, because they smelled a problem. There was in the air the feeling that there was animosity between the Russians and the Americans. I won't say any more than that because I don't know. But that was a feeling that we had, just me and my friends and whatever have you. So we went in, and we had in our battalion, we had a guy that was a civil engineer, and he designed the bridge. And he had nothing to work with because there was no steel or anything like that. But he designed a bridge that was made of timber. We had to go out and scout around because we had some woods there. We had to find trees that were of the right size. And then we found a couple of mills that were lumber mills that could machine the woods, the trees, down to big structural elements so that they could take the loads and so on and so forth. And so we bivouacked right there on site next to the creek. We spent about 2 months, all of us, and my platoon and rest of my company were active in manhandling this lumber and so on and so forth. Had to put up PVs to get the heavy timber up on top and so on and so on. And we finally finished that bridge, and we saw a tank go across it. That was good. It made us all feel like, hey, we did something. Yeah. And it made the Germans happy. Well, whoever lived there.
And where was that?
That was in Czechoslovakia. It's a Sudetenland.
Do you have any idea whether or not that bridge is still standing?
I don't know. I've never been back. Ed, I'm sorry that I didn't. I should have gone back, but I didn't.
It would be kind of fun to find out, wouldn't it, if your work stood the test of time?
Yeah, it would be. But I'm sure it's all gone now. I'm sure it's been replaced. The bridge was not in the city. It was on a highway that was a kind of key to the east-west. Then we had a vacation area. There was a couple of spas in the Sudeten area that were near woods. Part of that area was forests. Mm-hmm. And some of these spas had been there since before the turn of the century. And they had the registration book for Prince so-and-so and Prince so-and-so and Duke so-and-so from this country and that country from going way back. Hey, man, we were fed good. Oh, it was the same GI meat and all that kind of stuff, but when you got good cooks working for you. So that was good. That was fun. That was a good reward.
It's all about perspective, isn't it? Break time again, but there's much more to come with 97-year-old George Paul of Henderson, Nevada, including what it meant for him to visit the National World War II Memorial with Honor Flight Southern Nevada. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest. Did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma, because you can check out their Wall of Honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there, and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that Wall of Honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and one of those conversations that makes you do a bit of a double take. You might have already asked yourself, did he really say he's 97? Because George Paul probably sounds like a much younger man to you. He was a much younger man while serving with the 16th Armored Division during World War II. I've read that your division was credited with liberating Pilsen, Czechoslovakia, famous for Pilsner beer. Do you remember how the people there greeted you or treated you?
I never got to Pilsen, but in general, the village where the castle was, everyone treated us well. I mean, there was no animosity that you could feel or anything like that. And boys are boys.
Yeah, we can read between the lines on that one. Oh, I know what I forgot to ask you about. There was one incident, at least one, where hostilities haven't ended, you're in a combat area, and you guys in your half-track ended up somewhere you didn't know where you were, or you didn't realize where you were?
We did not realize where we were. That's correct. As a matter of fact, on our way from Germany, I think we were driving maybe a two and a half hours, and we kept seeing young men, young kids, really, teenagers, in gray uniforms. And it turned out that they were gunners, anti-aircraft gunners, in the forthcoming airfield where we were headed, I guess. And they were just walking in that direction, and we were driving in that direction. So it shocked us to see that they weren't afraid of us. They weren't armed, but they had their uniforms on. It's the only clothes they had, apparently, and they were just kids. And there was not just two or three of them, but they were kind of spaced out, and they were all heading home someplace.
So these were guys from the German Army?
German Army, that's correct. And we had learned later that they had been conscripted. They were generally like high school kids. And 14, maybe 16 years old at the most. And that's why they were trained to be gunners, because they couldn't spare older guys who could know how to kill.
So if they had been armed, you guys would have been outnumbered?
I think so. Well, maybe. Perhaps we'd have taken some fire.
I mean, that sounds like kind of a confusing moment for you.
Yes, it was. You didn't know how to react to it. Well, we were supposed to jump down with our M1s and tell them to halt. There was no one to tell us to do that.
So you just kind of kept going?
We kept on going because we were part of the point. So the point was a tank, and we were the second vehicle back. We just followed the guys in front of us.
That just sounds like one of those situations that could have gone a number of different ways.
Yeah, it could have.
But the way it went was probably the best.
It just happened. And so when we kept on going, and we came to a crossroads of some sort, and there was a larger town. I'm going to call it a town rather than a village, but it really was in our viewpoint, a village. And there was a three-story building in there, and the local citizenry told us that it housed the pilots and the crews, whoever had to work with the airplanes down the street, so to speak. Now, we didn't know they had a whole airfield down the street, but and so these had guys there, and they were armed. They had pistols on their belts and all that kind of stuff. And so what do we do? Just tell them, give me your gun? To me, it was weird. It was just plain weird. We should have disarmed them, but we didn't. And I know that we in approaching this building, we reverted back to training, and we hugged the wall, and we crept up on it as much as we could without exposing ourselves. So automatically you kind of go into that kind of a mode and so on. And then we got into the building and we saw all these mostly officers. Well, there must have been the pilots, what else? But they didn't talk English, so we didn't talk German, so. And then somebody from behind us came up and talked to us in English. One of our officers, I guess, is, hey, you guys, get back in your goddamn vehicles, blah, blah, blah. And so we turned around and walked back out to our vehicles, got in, and let's go. And then we stopped when we got to the airfield, because we weren't supposed to go any further than that. So that's what happened. That was the day before the treaty was signed.
The writing was on the wall.
It was on, yeah, but we didn't know it. Well, you're the guys that know the least, the doers.
You went back to school for engineering, and you ended up spending 30 years as an engineer with Boeing. What kind of stuff did you work on for Boeing?
Oh, goodness, it was a lot of things. It was a great life. I worked on... The reason why I went to Boeing is because Boeing at a point in time had designed and made and sold to the U.S. Navy a small gas turbine, and the gas turbine was used as a propulsion engine on the minesweepers. Now, the whole boat is made of wood so that it's not magnetically live to a mine, but by the same token, most of the engine was aluminum. The only steel was just in the blades and so forth. They liked the idea of using that kind of an engine. It was cheap enough and it was available. So I went to work for that division, and that got me into this and that and the other things. And I wound up being a test engineer, which meant I had ideas and try this and try that to make them more economical. Then I think we got into it with a Kenworth truck company, built a tractor trailer to experiment with that kind of propulsion engine, which had certain advantages to it because it didn't need a transmission. So we had that to play with. So I stayed with that for about 12 years with that division.
And that never caught on, did it? The jet-powered tractor trailer?
No, the tractor trailer did not. But it was for other reasons, because it turned out that it was more beneficial to the carrier than it was to anybody else. But in the final analysis, we found an application for it, or it found us. They made a guy had designed a drone helicopter that had contra-rotating rotors, so it didn't require a tail rotor. And so it was short, and it was easy to stow on a small hangar on the back of a destroyer. And so at that point, we were starting to get a little bit nose-to-nose with our so-called enemies in the Pacific area. And so the Navy wanted to get more life out of their tin cans, and they were all old boats. So they bought into the idea of the drone helicopter, which could carry a couple of ton. So I got into that one, and there I got into the design of the engine, and I designed a new reduction gear because it had to go to 6,000 RPM output shaft because that's what they wanted on their rotor, who knows, and so on and so forth. So I did that, and I stayed with that for a while, and then they put me as a liaison between our company and their company to go on the BIS trials, which is the trials for the Navy's acceptance of production birds, and so on and so forth. And so then I had to go out to sea with the Navy trial people, and that was a lot of fun. It was very, very interesting. I mean, to see how the Navy lives. So we went out there, and it so happens that that particular boat had held the championship ribbon for the Atlantic Fleet on speed. So it had done over 40 knots. Now, you got to say, it takes something. A boat, which is a destroyer, is a big boat. And to see that sucker going down the water with a rooster tail coming out the stern, hey, we're moving. It was fun, and it was very, professionally, it was good.
Well, I just have a couple more questions for you. Thanks for all your time. I'm sure we're glossing over a lot of things, but more recently, I think maybe about 5 years ago, you got to go on something even faster than that destroyer, a big jet that took you back to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada.
Yeah.
What was that experience like for you? What'd you get out of it?
It was a remarkable experience. I cried. I couldn't stop it. It's just that for people to think back that many years, and here we are, home as old men. We made this country better. And we did it not voluntarily, but we did it. Because once we got in it, once we got that uniform on, we were different people. All of us. All of us. There's always a bad guy once in a while, but it was okay.
If there were other things on the trip that stood out more, feel free to add that. But I'm just curious, since you served in World War II, you saw firsthand why the victory was so important, what difference it made. When you're at that National World War II Memorial, and they've got 4,000 gold stars representing over 400,000 Americans who gave their lives in the war. What were the things that came to mind while you were there?
Tears. Yeah, it's it overcomes you. That is a huge number of human beings that we, the American people, sacrificed to help the world get better. What else can you say? We made it better for all of us.
Well, I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a unique story that nobody else could share with us. Is there something, when you think back on 97 years, you've given us some highlights here and there, is there something that you would say that you are most proud of or most thankful for?
I'm proud of surviving, in the sense that I've stayed out of trouble and I've raised a couple of kids, given them a pretty fair. It's not necessarily a matter of ego pride. It's a matter of pride of having been a part of this society, and I think I'm a pretty good guy. I think I've been a good citizen. And if I had to do it again, I probably would do it again. What else is there?
Was there anything else I didn't ask you about that you think is important for us to know?
Things, but we don't have time. Thank you so very, very much for listening to an old man talk.
Well, what a privilege that has been. And a special thanks to Belinda Morse of Honor Flight Southern Nevada for connecting us to George. You can find an extended podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.